I'm Georgie Crawford. You're listening to the Good Glow podcast. Throughout my treatment for breast cancer, I've realised the importance of self-care. Whether that's a hike up the mountains, a checkup with your GP, or even a 5-minute pamper session, the time has come for us to put ourselves higher on our own to-do list. This season, I've teamed up with Sally Hansen. Sally Hansen herself was more than a beauty innovator and businesswoman. She believed in the importance of self-care all the way back in the 1930s. Sally Hansen believes that beauty is better when you do it yourself. So this summer, why not get a salon finish on your nails with Miracle Gel and a perfect flawless tan with the iconic Airbrush Lex Tan? And just like Sally herself, enjoy every self-caring moment of it. This week on the Good Glow podcast, I speak to Laura Nolan Horgan. Laura was 32 when she found out she was BRCA1 positive. Often referred to as the Angelina Jolie gene, it meant she had a higher risk of developing ovarian or breast cancer. At the time, Laura was pregnant with her third child, and after meeting with her doctors, it was decided she would have a hysterectomy as soon as possible and a double mastectomy in the months afterwards. Today, Laura speaks to me about menopause in her 30s, the amazing support network she had around her, and how, after everything she's been through, still feeling like herself, but an even better version. I'm so thankful to Laura for sharing her story with me on my podcast today. She is a very special, beautiful person. Laura, welcome to the Good Glow podcast.
Thank you so much. I can't believe I'm here. I was just admiring all this gorgeous space. I feel like I'm sitting in your living room. It's fabulous.
It's so good to see you. 2 meters apart, I can't actually hug you, but we will get that hug someday. It's the first time we've ever met each other, but we've been in contact over the last couple of years. I've been following your story and you've been following mine. And my God, you've been on some journey over the last couple of years. How do you feel now, having gone through all of that? Are you in a good place?
Yeah, I suppose I am. Do you know, it's a hard one. Having the BRCA gene is something that, well, it's a gene. It doesn't, even though I've done all I can do to help myself, it's still something that's always kind of, you wake up every morning and go, oh, do I have a lump? Do you know, is my skin okay? Like, you're searching yourself for, you're just constantly, every twinge, every pain you have, you think, oh God, is this something? But as time goes on, I'm nearly 3 years of knowing that I have it, 2.5. And as time goes on, you do become a bit more used to it, I guess. It becomes part of your normal life. And so I'm definitely in a better place than I was. But do I wish I was somewhere else or in a different place? Yeah, I mean, it's something... it's a life sentence, really, and it's something that nobody wants, but we can just do our best to, which I'm doing, to get on with it.
Lots of people would be familiar or maybe first encountered the word BRCA with Angelina Jolie when she wrote that open letter in the New York Times, I think it was, and explained that her mum had died young of ovarian cancer. She went to get the test and it came back that she was BRCA positive. So she decided to get some surgeries done, and she wanted to share a story to encourage women to check themselves and get the test if there's a history of cancer, a breast or ovarian cancer in her family. Tell us a little bit about BRCA, the BRCA gene, and what it is.
Yeah, so the BRCA gene, a lot of people, you're right, Angelina Jolie highlighted the BRCA gene. And to be honest, I'm not sure that I had ever heard of it before she had mentioned it. Like, when I heard the word BRCA, I was like, oh yeah, is that the thing that Angelina Jolie has? So thank goodness that she did that, because she really did bring, you know, like, helped so many people with sharing her story. But it's basically a tumor suppressing gene. So if you have cells in your body and in your ovaries and in your breasts, and when your cells are trying to kind of fix themselves, people with the BRCA can't, those cells can't basically be fixed. That's essentially it. So they turn into cancer. So it's a genetic gene. It's in families. Men can carry it. it gives them a smaller percentage of having prostate cancer, but it really mm-hmm. affects women. So if you have the BRCA1 gene, which I have, you can have up to a 90% chance of getting breast cancer in your lifetime, and ovarian will be 40 to 60%. BRCA2 gene is a similar gene, but your chances of getting ovarian or breast are slightly lower. So I often wonder, like, oh, do you wish you had, you know, would BRCA2 be easier or whatever? But they're both awful. But some part of me thinks that actually having the BRCA2 gene would nearly be harder, because even though my chances are worse, my decision process was a lot easier. Mm. So it was a no-brainer, in my opinion, and for me and for my family, to have a mastectomy or to have my hysterectomy. Whereas I think you'd really have to process that and think really hard if you had the BRCA2 gene, because I think their percentage in one of them anyway is about 20%. And that mm-hmm. to me would just be, oh God, you go through all of this. Like, the side effects of those surgeries are just so huge. You just wonder, you know? So look, it's an awful thing. And they seem to be doing a lot more research into it, but at the moment there's no cure, and it's just a lot of people are getting, rather than going down the surgery route, you know, a lot of people are getting screened, but unfortunately there's no screening for ovarian cancer. So mm-hmm. it's a minefield, the whole decision making process behind it. Like, everything is just difficult.
So with the BRCA gene, if one of your parents have it, you have a 50% chance of picking it up. So you either get it from your mum or your dad if you have the BRCA gene. Isn't that the way it works?
That's the way it works. So it wasn't really apparent in our family. So what happened was, in 2017, my cousin got breast cancer at a very young age. And she had just had her third child, and they tested her for the BRCA gene and she came back positive. So we never really thought that it was us or our side of the family, because my dad's one of five boys. My granddad, cancer wasn't a big thing in our family, and never has been. So anyway, when we all got the test, it turned out that it was her dad's side, my uncle. So my dad, then all of us were invited to be tested. Thankfully, only three of us have it out of everybody who was tested. There's still people who weren't. But out of the three of us, we're so lucky because we all have children. So there were some of my cousins that would have been tested that didn't have kids or aren't even engaged or married, whatever. And that would be difficult. It would mm-hmm. put so much pressure on you. So there are so many little things from this that I take that I'm grateful for. But the fact that we now have it, our kids, so I have two boys and a little girl, and they have a 50% chance of carrying the gene. Mm. That's a hard one to swallow every day. But I just pray to God by the time it comes. So the government in Ireland protects them, so they can't be tested until they're 18. And to be honest, it's something I toy with every day, because I'm sharing my journey with people. And I do that on Instagram, and I do it because I couldn't find anybody that was going through what I went through. And I just wanted to see real life stories. You know, I wanted to see somebody who went through that and what did it feel like. And Angelina Jolie, as amazing as she was for sharing her story, you can't find anything out about her. Like, I've stalked the woman, like, she mm-hmm. is so private.
It was that letter, and that was the end of
it. She's never shared anything else. I know she wears her patch on her arm because I see that every now and again, but no, she's like a closed door. So I find that really difficult. Michelle Heaton, actually, she wrote a book on it, but as great as it was to read her journey, it was kind of frightening. It was a tough read. I just felt that I needed something in between, you know?
So tell us then about making the decision to get the test. Like, did you sit down with your husband and have a big conversation about it? Was there a part of you that thought, maybe I won't get it?
No, there was never a part that I wasn't going to be tested. So I remember my mom was in Florida at the time, and I phoned her to tell her that we'd all been invited to be tested. And I explained the situation, and she just went into utter meltdown and then did a quick U-turn and was like, it was nearly, that was her one moment of letting the guard down. And then from there on in, like, she never whimpered ever again. That was it. And she was like, yeah, no, everything just turned practical, and was like, yeah, get the test done and you'll be fine. Ronan, my husband, is the same. He's so strong and just like, he works in finance and everything's about numbers. And he just went into all of this, well, now these are your options and these are the percentages. And this is where he was nearly like pulling up graphs on computer screens for me. I was like, Ronan, seriously, like, bring a bit of emotion into this. But that's not how he rolls. So it wasn't. Yeah, so I remember then I went and got tested. That was fine. And when you go, you get genetic counselling with this man. And did you, with David Gallagher's office? And he's so nice. But I'd say the man was worn out by the time we left, because Ronan, again, just went dug into the numbers. He was so mathematical about the whole thing. And, you know, even then when I got the news that I was positive, I'll never forget that. I was in my friend Emma's house and we were on a play date with the kids. And I had said, so my results were due to come before Christmas, and they separated us all out when they were testing us 2 weeks apart because our blood samples would be so similar. They didn't want any cross contamination. So my results would have come the week just before Christmas. So I said to Professor Gallagher, do you mind actually just ring me after Christmas? Because can you imagine getting that news before Christmas? I couldn't cope. So, and I'm such a Christmas person and kids, and I was pregnant and emotions were high. So I said, yeah, no, call me after Christmas. But on the Monday, on the Monday before, I phoned and I was like, I've changed my mind. I can't sleep. But it's okay because I know I actually don't have it. So if you could just call me back and just confirm like what my results were, that would be great. So I was in my friend Emma's house and the number came up. And you know, the way you just, I didn't have it saved on my phone, but you just know, you're like, okay. So I said to her, oh, you just watch the kids there for 2 seconds. And I went out to her hall and it was Professor Callagher, and he was being really weird. And he was like, can you confirm your date of birth? And I was like, oh, here, like, you just, it was just so serious, you know. There was no kind of plumosing with him or anything. And he was like, and your name and your address and whatever. And I was like, oh God. And I was just, even now talking about it, I can feel myself sinking. I'm like, oh, I just sunk, you know. It's just the ground fell from beneath me and I just fell to my knees. And I was like, oh my God, I cannot believe it. That was just my world turned upside down, you know. And I was just so conscious that instantly I was like, this isn't going to ruin my life and it's certainly not going to ruin my kids. So I just picked myself back up, walked into the room, and Emma could tell straight away. And I just looked at my kids and I was like, no, this is not going to happen. This is just, we're going to get through this. So I phoned around and I told him, and he was in work and I couldn't drive. I was like shaky, like I am now, Jesus. So he came to pick me and the kids up from Emma's house and we went home, and he took the rest of the, that was the Thursday before Christmas. So it was like 2 days before Christmas. So he took whatever the rest of the time off, and that Christmas was just like, you just think that it's your last Christmas. You think the worst, you know, you can't, it's so hard. You don't know, like, and because I was pregnant, I couldn't do anything. So it's so weird. There's so much about the timing that I'm like, Toby is my little firecracker. He's my baby. He's 2 nearly tomorrow. And he's such a dynamite little fella. Like, he's just mental. And the other two are these two angels, you know. So I was always walking around with like flicking my hair thinking, I've got this parenting thing down, you know. Like, people would be looking at me going, oh my God. And then Toby arrived, and like, he arrived 7 weeks early. And I get that now, because he was just on a mission. From the moment he's conceived, he's been on a roll. Like, he is just, he's dynamite. But I know that it was all for a reason, that I found out that I could potentially have BRCA, that I was pregnant all at the same time. I knew that even having that time to process everything, like, I had said straight away, if I have this gene, I'm going straight in, I'm getting every operation. Whereas because I was pregnant, I had to reflect. I couldn't do anything. I had time to kind of process it all.
And how pregnant were you?
So I found out at Christmas, so maybe 3 months then at that stage. Yeah, I think we started to tell our family actually. So I was 3 months. So I had a while to go. Probably a little too long. If he had come a bit earlier, that would have been great because the processing just went on and on. But he was such an amazing distraction, you know, through all of this. He's just been like, he doesn't give you time to think for 2 minutes. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of, he is such a blessing. And even after, you know, after I had him, my plan was to have my first operation 6 weeks later. And he also
came. Oh,
that's
so soon after having a baby, in terms of like just even emotionally, yeah, to face that after having a baby.
Yeah, so it was a really hard one. So the problem with it is, God, I don't want to like scare people now, but when you are pregnant, it increases your chances, mm-hmm, of getting things. Your body is going through so many changes and lots of cells are growing. And that's what, you know, that's what.
Yeah, it could trigger something.
It could trigger something. So, and especially ovarian cancer and being pregnant, you know, and they do think actually ovarian cancer potentially starts in your fallopian tubes. So it's all just a bit, it was all just a bit frantic, you know. But my daughter, and funny, I needed an end to it, you know, having the 10 months of pregnancy and 10 months of processing all of this, I needed it to be over. Like, mm-hmm, I needed the operation just to be done so I could at least tick one box off my list, you know.
So did you sit down with a doctor and did they say, we are advising you to get a mastectomy and a hysterectomy?
Georgie, you know as well as I do, doctors today are unbelievable and they guide you and they help you, but they really ultimately put the decision into your hands. Mm-hmm. They don't, for my breast surgery, they were, so our history shows that ovarian cancer was our problem in our family. So usually you have a pattern as to if one is worse than the other, and it was ovarian cancer in our family. And that's scary because there's no screening for it, you know. So all through my pregnancy with Toby, I was getting mammograms and they were fine and there was nothing there. And they probably were encouraging me to continue screening longer than I did. They do suggest that if you can hold off on your operations until you're 40, mm-hmm, that would be a better option, because I suppose definitely for your hysterectomy, it has so many altering side effects. But for us, that wasn't an option because a lot of our family died in their early 30s of ovarian cancer. So that's why we all started with that operation. And I did. And I didn't really have too much time to waste on that, I felt. But going through the decision making process, oh my God, like, 1 minute you're a strong and you're going, oh yeah, yeah, take my, sure, I'll be fine. Like, and yeah, I'll get on with it and I'll be grand. And then the next minute you're on your knees going, I can't, like, my quality of life is just going to be so different. And you panic. But that operation, having the hysterectomy and my ovaries and everything removed, was the worst experience ever. It was just, the buildup was way worse than the actual operation or even afterwards.
The buildup, like in your head, or
in my head, yeah, it nearly killed me. Like, I just didn't. I thought I was going into this operation, and you know, all the side effects, like osteoporosis, hair loss, weight gain, depression. It's just the menopause. There was just so much to it that I couldn't get my head around it. I just felt that I was never going to be me again. I was going to be a different person. I was going to wake up and I wasn't going to be crack anymore, and I wasn't going to be as good a mom, and I was going to be tired, and I wouldn't have the energy for my kids, and I wouldn't be as able and fit. And I just really struggled with that. You know, it was like that build up out of my whole journey, that build up was 100% the hardest, because I didn't know what it was going to do to me. Do you know, there was just so many side effects, and I didn't know how I was going to change, or if I was going to change, or It was weird, very hard.
So the day of the operation, how long did the operation itself take?
That operation, it's funny. Do you know, I remember every step of my breast surgery, probably because that was 6 months ago. But that operation, I was in such a haze. I was really mentally struggling at that time. Even though I felt I was so strong and I was exercising all the time and everything, like that whole day nearly is just a haze. My one memory is saying goodbye to Ronan at the lift, and I was in my gown and ready to go. And I thought that was, I was never going to see him, or he was never going to see me again as I was, as the person that he married. And that just killed me. And I remember I was in the same room that I had Toby in for the operation. So that was weird. In hindsight, I probably should have re-looked at my hospital location, you know, because it was tough being in a maternity hospital having that operation. And even though I have three wonderful kids and I'm delighted, being told that you can never have another child again was just...
so final.
It's so final. And I was sitting in this room and this gorgeous Filipino nurse came into me and, oh my God, she was amazing. And she was honestly just amazing. I don't know what she said to me or what she did, but like she held my hand and walked me down. Like she was just incredible. And then she actually came back to me like 2 days later and told me that she took her boys out of school that day and they all went to mass and lit me a candle that night.
Oh,
like people are
God.
Just so nice. I just couldn't cope with how nice everybody was. And I think they were all a bit shocked, you know, in the Coombe before. It's a student hospital, obviously, and these two young guys came in, Jesus, God love them, looking back, they came in to do my pre-op kind of questionnaire, you know, but they were students. And they said, like, the main doctor came in beforehand and was like, is this okay? And then kind of looking, once he saw the situation, he was like, oh Jesus, we've gone too far now. But and I was like, yeah, no problem, no problem. So the first question was, and what was and the first, what was the first day of your last period or whatever? And then there was questions like that. And I kept explaining, you know, like what was happening. And then he said, and have you thought about what form of contraception you're going to use after your operation? And I was like, well, actually, do you know, I'm having my ovaries and everything removed. And he just kept, like, the poor boy, like he was, what, 20 or something. He was just sinking into his chair further and further. And every question, he'd say it out loud and then go, oh God, no, sorry, sorry. And he was just crossing them out. But it's funny now, everywhere I go that I have to fill out a form or something, it's what's the first day of your last period? Are you on any, do you know, is there any chance that you can be pregnant? Is there, and I'm just like, N-A. And at the start, I was like, this is so unfair. Like, why am I having to go through this every single time? Like, it should be, the first question should be, are you menopausal? Yes, okay, skip to the last page. Do you know,
yeah,
you shouldn't,
yeah.
Like, and a lot of people would know, you know, you're, like, these are doctors and whatever that would know why I'm there, do you know? So it's just
so
those
difficult.
Generic forms just kill you. Mm. Like,
I remember when I was getting my breast surgery, not the same because I wasn't obviously having the same operation as you, but I remember everyone kept asking me if I was pregnant. Everywhere you go, every test, every machine you get into, are you, is there a chance you could be pregnant? And I felt like screaming. I have a 7-month-old baby at home. I'm 32. I have cancer. Do you not think I wish I was pregnant instead of sitting here with cancer?
Yeah.
Like, but you know, it's just so hard. Those forms can destroy your soul.
They can destroy your soul. Like, I remember getting my DEXA scan there recently and it was the same thing again. And any chance you could, I was just going, oh my God, please God, somebody do something with these bloody forms. They're just awful. But you just, oh, there's just so many times where you just suck it up, swallow it and move on, you know. And that's just life. You've just got to keep on trucking, like, it's, you know, and there are times you're just going, oh my God, what next, what next? But
how much more can I take?
How much more can you take?
Do you remember waking up from your first operation?
I do remember waking up from my first operation because I was in the same ward, recovery ward, that I was with when I'd had Toby, which was a couple of months previous. Even doctors were walking by, and nurses, maternity nurses, and they were like, oh, you're back. It's like, yeah, I'm back. But when I got back to my room, this amazing nurse came into me and she was like, now, the chances of you getting night sweats and whatever tonight are probably high, you know, like it's not, you don't kind of slowly go into the menopause when it happens surgically, it happens straight away. So she was like, just give me a shout, like if you need, you know, any help or whatever. So the operation itself, pain wise, it was kind of like a C-section, like it wasn't, and I suppose I was off my goofballs on pain relief and whatever. So the pain was actually okay. But yeah, I hit the menopause with the full blown, like I just crashed into a wall. It was, oh my God, I was shocked actually at how sudden and instantaneous it was. I was lying there going, oh my God, I can't breathe, like dripping sweat just pouring from me, really hot flushes, and then gradually over time just this brain fogginess, like really bad brain fogginess, like newborn baby fuzziness, but worse. And then not being able to sleep, like just lying awake at night, just really not being able to sleep, and it just built up and just got worse and worse. Everything just got worse. And then I got my DEXA scan results, and they were like, and that was like 3 months later or something, and already they were like, you have osteopenia. And I was like, oh my God. So yeah, and then stupid things, you know, just kept happening, and it was just, the menopause was tough, you know. And I kept, even though some things were probably happening anyway, I was blaming everything on the menopause, you know, it was just escalating it all. But I went to this woman in the menopause clinic, actually it was on TV3 on Ireland AM one morning. One of my pals phoned me, and she was like, oh my God, Laura, they've opened a place called the Menopause Hub. And I was like, amazing, like where is it? And they were like, Mount Mary. And I was like, what? It's on my doorstep. So I booked an appointment and went down and met this woman called Dr. Deirdre Lundy, and she's from America, and oh my God, the woman changed my life. So I walked in and I told her my story, and she burst into tears, and she was like, I cannot believe you are 32 and you left a hospital with no drugs for the menopause, no nothing, like no help. No, she was like, you've got a newborn at home. She was like, actually, I'm astonished at how you're sitting here and how you actually managed to pick up a phone and call me. She was just, and I then burst into tears. I was like, finally, somebody actually understands what I'm going through. And it was just such a relief. And since then, I see her all the time and we're best buds, and she's constantly coming up with tips and tricks and God knows what she's going to put on me next. But it, like, it's some things could be, you know, herbal and whatever. She's just an amazing, amazing woman. She's now setting up a clinic, I think, in Holles Street, and she's just like this menopause guru. Like, she knows everything. And yeah, I was just so blessed, like so blessed to find her.
I think with the menopause, like you'd look at your mom like fanning herself at the door, yeah, and it's all very funny and everyone's slagging her, you know, having a hot flush.
Yeah.
I went into a temporary menopause when I was in chemo, and it's hell on earth because you wake up in the middle of the night and it's like your blood turns to lava. It's that feeling, isn't it? Yeah. Of just so hot. All of a sudden you can't sleep, like you say, because you can't cool down.
Yeah.
And especially what happened to you, that as you said, you went into that sudden menopause. Like, for many people it happens gradually over time.
Yeah.
But all your symptoms hit you that night.
Yeah, it was, yeah, you burn, as opposed to feeling hot, you're burning, you know. It's and then my biggest issue really, and then I had this fatigue, like, which was like no other, you know. And then trying to just be a happy mom every day and just wanting,
put your best foot forward.
Jesus, just wanted to bang my head off a wall, you know. It was just, it was rough. It was rough. But after I found Deirdre, she managed to put me on a track and on a road that I'll be on for the rest of my life. But she's really helping my like honestly, she's like my guardian angel. Like, she just has saved me. And it worries me that so many people, like GPs and doctors and everything, are amazing here, but menopause isn't something that's really, you know, even my mom now, she's like, I think I'm gonna go down to Deirdre. I'm like, you've been in the menopause for about 20 years. And she's you know, but back then it was just there was a taboo kind of around the menopause, you know. Even now, like I I'm the stick of so many jokes about the menopause, you know, and I just kind of laugh them off and I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah. And then I'm saying to my friends, I'm in the menopause. And they're like, oh, God, yeah, sorry, sorry, sorry. But there are, it is a kind of, it's a topic that probably needs a good bit more research done. And I think women need a good bit more help. You can't possibly go through, it's just not fair, you know, and it's not needed either. Like there is medication out there that can help.
Yeah. So what happened then in terms of your breast surgery?
What happened then? So I wanted to have my breast surgery straight away. I was adamant that I wanted to get to the end of 2019 or 2018. I wanted to get to the end of the year. Oh my God, this 2020 thing has thrown me. I wanted to get to the end of the year and just sign it off. And I wanted to start a new year in 2019 with nothing.
And just get on with your life as best you could.
Yeah. So my doctors were like, absolutely no way, Laura, like no way. You have a newborn baby and this neck surgery that's ahead of you is physically tough. Never mind emotionally and mentally. So they were just saying that really Toby should be up and walking by the time I have my neck surgery. Yeah, I suppose, do you know what, there was no harm in leaving all that space in between, because it was letting me get to terms with the menopause, settle into my past surgery, recover from that. Like recovering from a hysterectomy is, you have to be really careful, because even though you don't really feel the pain on the outside, you have so many internal stitches. I think I had 600 internal stitches in me.
My God.
Yeah, so you can't, you have to be really careful, move slowly and take it
easy. How did you manage?
Mind yourself. Well, Toby was tiny, so that kind of helped. They allowed me to carry him as long as I held him close to my chest.
Right.
The other two obviously were up and walking at that stage. Hugo was nearly 3 and Elizabeth was 4. So Toby was tiny, so you could hold as much as a kettle. So I just got on with it. My mom was unbelievable. Oh my God. And my husband was amazing. My friends were amazing. My mom moved into our house for that operation and she basically turned into Toby's mom, and she goes, mom, and Elizabeth's mom. She was amazing. And my husband then kind of looked after me. Do you know, it was kind of, we did a bit of a juggling act for a while, but I just looked after myself, threw myself back into exercise then as soon as I could. I found this lady on Instagram called Kate, and she's based in the UK, and we've become such good friends as well through all of this. She's just one of life's just wonderful people, and she was doing all these home workouts, and through all my surgeries I just did them all with her. Like every morning at 6:30 I'd be up as soon as I could. And
on Instagram?
Yeah, on wow. Instagram, yeah. Instagram's just amazing. Like, it's helped me so much, even just talking about my story and sharing it all. There's times where I'm like, oh my God, I can't tell them this. This is just horrendous. And then I'm like, no, this is the reason I'm doing this. I would have wanted to know.
Mm-hmm.
But I've really found it so therapeutic talking about it, and the support and the kindness and compassion that people have has just been amazing. But I was always so conscious that I wasn't doing this to look for sympathy. Do you know, I wanted to do this to be factual. I wanted it to be helpful for people. So I find that kind of difficult, because I was, you know, people would be like, oh my God, I can't believe you're going through this. And I'm so sorry. I'm like, oh, no, don't be sorry. It's fine. You know, I'm fine. Like, I'm fine. I'm just, I need to document this for someone else who's going to go through this journey, which so many people, I can't get over, like the BRCA community and how many young people, and even in like Ireland that have it, you know, there's so many. So I'm really glad. And actually now nearly once a week, somebody finds out that they're BRCA positive and they've been shared or been guided to my page, you know, and they just find that so helpful. To be able to, because my journey's there from day one, you know. Anyway, sorry, I'm totally going off the track here. But yeah, so I moved on to my breast surgery. Then they wanted me to wait till Toby was walking. So he started walking, and we decided then that we were going to do my surgery in, it was funny because I was going to do it in the summer, and then you do everything kind of that suits your kids and your family, you know, but I was saying, well, I'd rather that my kids were back in school. And Elizabeth found my first surgery really difficult, like when I was, because it's always me that drops her to school and picks them up, and Ronan had to do it this time, and like the teacher was like peeling her off Ronan every day, and it just didn't work. So I wanted her to be back in school for when the surgery started, but I wanted to kind of prep her for it, and I wanted the teacher to be prepped, and I just wanted her to be really settled back in. And she was a year older, so that was helpful, and she was fine with it. Actually, they were all fine, they were great, they had a ball without me, they ran riot around everybody. But I had my next operation in Vincent's Private, and Colin Morrison was my plastic surgeon, and Dennis Evoy was my surgeon who did my mastectomy. But it was a weird one. Like, that surgery, I struggled the most with being told that I couldn't keep my nipples. I find that just, I don't know. There's a lot to do with this surgery that every, like, all your womanhood's been taken. Do you know, I've no ovaries, I've no womb, I've now no breasts, but I had in my head that I was going to try and spare my nipples for the sake of just feeling like a woman, you know? And my skin is so fine on my chest from having three kids. Mm-hmm. I breastfed two of them. I didn't breastfeed Toby for that reason, that hopefully my skin would kind of harden up, you know? But I have fine skin actually naturally, I think, everywhere. Anyway, look, you think fine skin's a great thing, but it's not when you're stuck in situations like this. So they just said, no, it would be too risky and it wouldn't, like, it just wouldn't work. They also suggested that I took skin grafts from my back to kind of as another, they give you all these options and they do make recommendations based on your skin and your size and all the rest. But I was just like, do you know what? I decided that I'd actually be happy if they just took my breasts away and I didn't have reconstructive surgery, because I didn't want skin grafts from my back, and I didn't want, everybody's different and everybody mm-hmm. has their own process that they go through it. But I just thought, I want this to be as simple as possible. I want this to be over with as quickly as possible, and I want to be back to myself as quickly as possible. I just want to get on with my life and just put all of this behind me. But there's time, so I walk into my surgeon and I tell him this, and he's like, well, I'm not doing that, because Laura, you're, how old was I then? 34, and you've got so much ahead of you, and your bikini days are no longer gone, and you're going to be fabulous and you're going to be fine, you know. So even though I say they put the decisions into your hands, they do, when you make decisions like that, pull you back and say, no, like, come on, we'll figure this out. So I went ahead with my mastectomy and reconstruction surgery at the same time. So I think it was like a nearly 10-hour operation without skin grafts and no nipples. And weirdly, like, even now, like, the breast care nurses are just angels, mm-hmm. like full-blown angels. And the day they took my bandages off, like, they were all like, oh my God, you look amazing. I was like, I can't even look. Like, you guys are just, but they just made me feel like I was like literally on some catwalk for Victoria's Secrets. And I was like, oh my God, I can't look. So whatever I don't know what they do, like, but it's obviously all, you know, they're trained people, but they're got the kindest.
They go above and beyond.
Oh my God, like, they couldn't be nicer. So I just kept not being able to look. And then they were like, do you want to touch them? I was like, God, no. Like, I just, even now, like, they're still very alien to me. Mm. But just before COVID, actually, I was in with Colin Morrison, because you'd get these pains, you know, and like, you could have, the breast surgery itself is extremely painful, like, afterwards, I'm not going to lie. Like, it was, I had days where I was like, no, there's something wrong. I was convinced I was getting an infection. And you really, it's a really high risk surgery, especially when you find skin as well, for infection. So, and if, like, you get an infection. The tiniest little hole can cause an infection. If that happens, it's not a case of, oh, there's coercive antibiotics. It's back into the surgery. It's the breast has to come out. You then have to wait 6 months and then have it done again. So, like, you just don't want an infection, you know. But Colin was so clever. Like, he knew I wanted to get home so badly to see my kids. Like, I was demented in there. But every day he'd come in and give me a bit of hope and then leave. He knew, like, he wasn't saying too much, but I don't know how he did it. But he managed me to get to stay there for 10 days, which I think is quite long to stay in hospital after that surgery. But he just knew that with Toby being the age he was and whatever, it just didn't make any sense to take any extra risks. But
it's so nice to be, like, minded like that sometimes,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah,
it for really for is. People to take the decision out of your hands, yeah. And kind of say, no, this is what we're going to do. This is the plan. And you just go, okay, thank God.
Yeah, totally. But just before COVID, I went into Colin and I was telling him that I had some sort of pain or whatever. I can't remember what it was now. But he was having a look at my breasts and he was like, do you know what? He was suggesting that one of them is a bit, like, a little bit wonky. So he was like, we could take fat from somewhere else, basically, and put it in and it would be fine. And I was like, oh, I was like, oh my God, deadly, take it off my hips. Like, let's go. But yeah, you have to go under an anesthetic. So I was like, no, that's not going to happen. But it's funny now. And he was saying, you know, about, I had decided I was going to get tattoos. I'd always wanted a tattoo anyway. Do you know, like, even when I was younger, I always had this thing for guys with tattoos and I always wanted one. And I just thought, like, that they were just the coolest things ever. And, like, if you met my husband, he's the most nerdiest guy, like, said the word tattoo around him, he would just, like, yeah, no. But I was like, oh my God, maybe this is my way now of getting my tattoo. So he gave me a number of this woman. He was like, phone her, and she's absolutely amazing. And I rang her and I was like, I'm kind of nervous about it because I just feel like my whole body isn't me. Do you know that way? Like, that my breasts don't, like, they're not mine. And thank God the skin is my own, even though I do have a layer of, it's actually pig skin in between my implants and my skin. But I was like, the nipple thing is just like, that's going to be another alien thing, you know? And she was like, oh no, you'll be fine. Just, I'll book you in. And I was like, for a chat. And she was like, no, I'll book you in for the tattoos. And I was like, do you know what? I'll give you a call back. And I was always fearful that Elizabeth would be the one who'd see my breasts and be freaked out by seeing just two scars. But actually, she took it so well that now I'm like, oh, I don't know if I could be, I don't know, I think I might stick a sticker on them for a while or something and just see how it feels.
Yeah.
But weirdly, I don't feel any less womanly without them. I don't feel like all those fears that I had aren't real. Do you know, they're not, I don't know. I just, as tough as it's all been, and like even listening back or reading my own story when I was telling you it, and I'm just like, is that actually me? Like, it all seems like a lifetime ago. It feels like someone else. Like, life's just so busy in our house and my kids are just my life, and I just don't dwell on, like, my fears of not feeling like a woman. I'm like, well, like, when am I going to sit down and think about those fears, do you know? Yeah. Like, it just, I put on my clothes, my makeup and whatever, and I'm exactly the same person that I was before this, if not a better person, who takes every day as the best day in the world, and every moment with my kids I cherish. And I've always been a very patient person. It's one of my strengths, and I'm now even more patient.
And the fact that your surgeries will have lessened the chance of you getting breast cancer, I think it goes down to 5% or something with breast, does it?
Yeah, so I've less of a chance. I think it's, yeah, between 3% and 5%. So I've less of a chance of getting breast cancer than someone else that doesn't even have the gene.
And does that make you, do you feel more secure now, or do you still feel scared of cancer?
Oh, I wish I did feel more secure. There is a bit of a weight lifted, definitely. And look, it's there. As my husband has it in the numbers. It's there, but no, like the BRCA gene, unfortunately, has other cancers, and it has, you know, skin cancers quite high, and so I'm constantly in, like, I'd say my dermatologist is ready to kill me at this stage. Like, I'm constantly just sending her photos, being like, is this okay? She's like, that's totally fine, that looks like a little spot. I'm like, is this okay? And she's like, looks like a little freckle. I'm like, okay. And has colon cancer, so I have to have colonoscopies every year. There's just, and then a lady that we all know, an author, and she was, ended up being a good pal of ours when we were out in Fashion City. She used to come out to us and get all her gear from us on, I worked in out in Fashion City with my mom for 11 years, and this gorgeous lady, Emma Hannigan, she had the BRCA gene, and she had all the surgeries that I had and still went on to have breast cancer 10 times after those surgeries. So that is always at the back of my mind. It's something that you try and forget about, but it's kind of hard. You learn how to live with it, and you grow stronger the more you learn, and the longer you've had with the gene. But no, to answer your question, the fear doesn't really go away that much.
And if you get a message from someone on Instagram who's saying, like, you know, I've been following your journey and I'm thinking of getting the test, like, would you encourage them to get it?
Yeah, I absolutely would. It used to drive me insane. Everybody would say, aren't you so lucky that you know that you have this gene? And I, like, honestly, towards the end, I was like, I'm going to punch the next person that tells me I'm lucky. Like, this is the most unluckiest thing to have. It's not, but I get it. I understand that knowledge is power, and that's where they're all coming from. And I know it myself that I'm lucky, but it just seems so unfair to say that I'm lucky in this situation. But to anybody who thinks that they could potentially have it, yes, absolutely. In a way, you know, do I wish that I didn't have it? No, but am I glad that I do know that I do? Yeah, you know, it's a really hard one. Mm. But yeah, I mean, if you've been invited to be tested, absolutely go.
And what do you wish people had said to you instead of, you know, like, people when they meet you would go, oh, you're so lucky that you know, because maybe they're panicking, yeah, they don't know what to say. Like, what would have been helpful for you to hear at that time?
Well, for instance, now if somebody sends me a message to say, I've just found out that I'm BRCA positive and, you know, I'm whatever feeling, however they're feeling, my instant reply to them is, I am just so sorry. If there's anything that I can do to help, you know, ask me any questions, and just be rest assured that the time that you're in at the moment is the worst out of the whole journey that you're going to be on. That time of the unknown, the decision making, the figuring it all out, the coming to terms with it, that's the hardest. That is just brittle. Mm. So once you get over that and you start your journey and you get through your first operation or your first screening or your first mammogram or whatever it is, it all starts to sink in and kind of starts to make a bit more sense.
Yeah, so instead of almost trying to put a lid on it or saying, you know, oh, you know, you're lucky you found it, or you'll be back to yourself in no time, you'd rather hear, I feel your pain.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We are here for you. We support you.
Yeah.
And we are so sorry.
Yeah.
I think that's such good advice, because unless you've lived a situation or it's happened to you, it's so hard for people to know what to say. And people always have the best intentions, I think. So I think by having these conversations on podcasts and educating ourselves and women supporting women, you know, we can make the world we live in a better place and a more supportive place.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I'm going to be honest, I was even nervous coming on talking about this with you, because you've had breast cancer, you know, I haven't. And it's a funny one, because you feel like being diagnosed with the BRCA gene, you're not quite as worthy as somebody who actually has cancer. Do you know, it's, you have to go through the mental process, and I had to go through those operations, but I never had to go through the treatment or the, do you know, it's a really difficult kind of thing. So people in my situation call me lucky, whereas, do you know, they have the sympathy goes to you, which I get. Like, I'm not, you know, putting your situation down. It was absolutely horrendous. Like, they're all bloody horrendous. But I just feel that BRCA people kind of have to take a step back and be like, thankful for our situation. It's really, really, anyone who has BRCA has this same struggle. It's like, yeah, you feel a little bit hard done by, because you have to be grateful and thankful for your situation. And it just doesn't make any sense.
Absolutely.
It just doesn't. Like, even I went to the ARC for counselling, and it's the most magical place. And everyone, again, is just so kind and amazing. But I just felt so bad. I kept apologising for being there. I was, you know, going through a really difficult time, but I was saying to her, like, maybe, you know, I could talk to you somewhere else. Like, I just felt so bad, you know, I just felt like I was taking up her time for people that actually really needed it. You know, it just, I do, when I was going through all this process, a lot of consultants and stuff that I came across gave me these questionnaires to fill in, and they were saying they're trying to do something more for the BRCA community because of exactly how I felt and situations that were put into, you know. So I do hope they do something, because it really, people with the gene shouldn't have to be apologizing for being in situations that they're put into, you know. It's, yeah, we are lucky that we know, but no, we're not lucky that we have it. So it's, yeah,
I think it's, you explained it so well. So for anyone who wants to follow your journey on Instagram, just tell us your Instagram name.
Yeah, it's Laura Nolan Horgan. Sorry. Holding on to my roots.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. Appreciate it so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Good Glow podcast, with thanks to Sally Hansen. As we all find ourselves washing our hands so much more these days, why not take better care of our nails with Sally Hansen's Cuticle Oil or Complete Care 7-in-1. You can shop the products at grocery stores and pharmacies nationwide, such as Dunn Stores and Macaulay's Health and Beauty, and online too. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review. And for more of my story, follow me on Instagram, georgie.com.